Many, many years ago, I quit making New Year's resolutions. It had become clear to me that I would never keep those promises I made to myself. I knew I would never do what I had resolved to do every day without fail for an entire year. In those days long ago, when I still vowed at each New Year's beginning that I would keep without fail those promises to myself, all, of course, guaranteed to fail, my resolutions were usually about diet or exercise or some form of self-betterment. Surely my aims would have appeared among any top 10 list of what we have come to believe we are supposed to be, want, have, or do. Having a perfect body, being a 10, being a perfect partner or parent, writing perfect papers, singing with perfect pitch, skiing without falling, dancing like a pro, owning the right car or the newest version of word perfect. Do you remember that? Getting bigger and better promotions year after year, maybe even quarter after quarter, flashing perfect teeth through perfectly parted lips formed in perfect smiles. Seeking perfection, as in striving to achieve an ideal, is in itself not the problem. But perfectionism, the self-chastisement, the sense of inadequacy, and especially the shame and guilt that go with knowing one is not perfect, that's what takes the toll. Seeking to perfect an idea, to improve upon an invention, to understand something never before understood, to do something better than we or someone else has ever done it before, that can keep us going. It can inspire us. That kind of seeking may be intrinsic to our nature. Believing we have to do it all and do it flawlessly in a state of supreme excellence, as my Oxford Dictionary says, is what gets us in trouble with ourselves and with others. Last year, as in recent years past, I did not make a New Year's resolution. I did, however, sign up for the New York Times 30-day wellness challenge. I figured I could live with a 30-day commitment, especially since I didn't have to do it all over in 30 days. I could simply download each day's instructions and comply in my own time. While I knew from the day I signed on that I could not and would not engage perfectly, I really believed I'd get through the practice. I did not. So this year, because I downloaded all of those instructions, I have made another resolution. I'm going to start all over again. Perhaps the most important thing I've learned from this is that I can live with and laugh at the facts of my many imperfections. Maybe this has something to do with growing up. Perhaps I have finally begun to accept that no matter how hard I try, no matter what I work to prove, or to whom I strive to prove something, I will never be a perfect friend, or partner, or parent. Nor will I ever be a lithesome 5'8" goddess, or have everything every television advertisement tells me I should have. No matter how many A's I have gotten, and I have worked hard on that for a lifetime, I will not be better loved or better admired, nor will I do a better job, especially of caring for myself. In days gone by, something rare happened at our house. My husband Larry and I had conversations about a subject of his research in which we actually found a common language. Larry is a theoretical physicist, and rarely am I able to meet him in his world. As I started thinking and talking about perfectionism, Larry responded by telling me about the element silicon. Crystalline silicon is the primary ingredient of computer chips, as many of you know. It lies at the heart of a computer's ability to store and to move information, to communicate. Larry specialized at Bell Laboratories and then at the University at Albany in the study of defects, the imperfections of silicon. Among other things now known about crystalline silicon is that if it had no defects, if it had no defects, if it were perfect, there would be no computers. Silicon must be imperfect for it to do what it is supposed to do, to be what it is supposed to be, at least when it comes to computing. So for the moment, I'm going to just note this. At the heart of all living things, as you know, is DNA. If there were no imperfections in DNA, it is likely that there would be far less of life on this earth and that it would be far, far less interesting. So I'm going to come back to that in a few minutes. To summarize the outcome of my conversations with Larry, I paraphrase one of our better-known UU ministers, Robert Fulghum. All I needed to know about perfectionism, I learned from defects in silicon. From the study of defects in silicon, we can conclude at least three things. First, there is no such thing as a perfect silicon crystal, except in the imaginations of chemists and physicists. Second, the closer to perfect that a silicon crystal is, the more rigid it becomes and the more likely it is to shatter. And third, the presence of some defects in silicon actually enhances their ability to function under stress. Rather than breaking because they're imperfect, they are able to change and to adapt because they're imperfect. So this is the first lesson. When we recognize that perfect silicon crystals are simply products of the imaginations of chemists and physicists, we are connected with an ancient idea in Western culture. In Plato's Allegory of the Cave, written about 2,400 years ago, Socrates suggested that everything we experience as reality is merely the shadow of a perfect world that can never truly be experienced. Like perfect silicon, a perfect world can only be imagined. And imagine we have. But let us remember that each of us has designed our own ever-elusive ideas about what constitutes perfection. Each of us came to a decision when we were children regarding what it means to be perfect. Interactions with family members, message after message in the media, and the vast propensities of our society to litigate constantly refuel those images. Our ideas come from what we still think our parents expected. At least that's true for me. We learned those rules so well because they, our parents, were bigger and stronger than we were. They were always right, and of course, they always knew what was best for us. Grammar school teachers taught us what it meant to be perfect, wielding mighty red pencils and pens, surely forming faultless letters and admonishing us to color within the lines. Just for a moment, imagine at the invitation of the authors of the book, The Joy of Imperfection, what it would have been like if we had been generously rewarded for enjoying school, coming in fourth rather than first, or being relaxed, comfortable, and satisfied. Through religious education, Some of us gained considerable knowledge regarding what constitutes perfection. Sunday school teachers, Jewish and Christian, knew, we thought, what God expected. Even those of us who were not taught directly about God's expectations had friends who had been properly taught, and they in turn trained us. Indeed, some of our most powerful teachings about perfection have come to us through Judaism and Christianity. These teachings, along with those of Plato and Socrates, lie at the very foundation of our culture. But did God really expect perfection? In the story of creation, God saw that each act was good. Good, not perfect, entirely adequate to its purpose, according to Peake's commentary on the Bible, which was published 100 years ago. Soon we will see that there is a connection between Peake's interpretation of the word good as entirely adequate to a purpose and the meaning of perfect as it has been frequently used in the Bible, but imperfectly interpreted. Our notions of perfection are powerful products of our minds, always, always informed by culture. The seeking of perfection has been known to capture spirits and sometimes to destroy the souls of those who strove too seriously to attain what they believed to be an ideal. From the study of silicon, our second lesson is this. The more nearly perfect a crystal, the more rigid it becomes, the more likely it will be to shatter. That which is perfect may fail catastrophically. Perfection, interpreted as being without fault or flaw, as some biblical passages have indeed suggested, contributes to some of the greatest harms we do to others and to ourselves. We know all too well, for example, that some, seeking bodies defined by our culture as perfect, sacrifice physical, emotional, and mental health, relationships with others, and ultimately for some, their own lives. Seeking to perfect our partners or our children, and sometimes our friends and colleagues, we may sacrifice relationships or aspects of those relationships that we most value and desire. Wishing for perfect parents, which none of us ever had and none of us will ever be, we are likely to submerge ourselves in seas of self-destructive emotions. Anger and rage, shame and blame get too much in the way of forgiveness and love. These strong emotions get in the way of genuine acceptance of our imperfections and therefore of our humanity. Anger and rage, shame and blame are at the core as well of what is perhaps the single most destructive form of communal perfectionism, racism, although it is not the only of an abundance of exclusionary isms. And here we might say particularly the notion of white supremacy, the notion that white people are at the apex of humanity, a notion which has contributed for 400 years and more and still to the venomous hate that has fueled, most apparently, killings across this country in Charlottesville, Charleston, Pittsburgh, and most recently, New York. To the notion that walls at our borders should keep out racists and murderers, people who want simply to find shelter within a country once believed to be welcoming. A perfectionism in its most insidious forms that has created systems that have silenced voices, and who knows how much creativity has been lost. There have been and continue to be great prices associated with some of our erroneous beliefs about what constitutes perfection. Countless human beings have died. Millions have been exiled to the status of less than in the name of others' concepts of perfection, of that which has been thought to be the best or the only right way. Perfectly imperfect humans seeking their own perfection hurt themselves and often those they care most about. Perfect silicon shatters. So we come to the third lesson. The presence of some defects in silicon crystals actually enhances their ability to function under stress. Rather than crumbling when things heat up, they are able to change and to adapt because of their imperfections. We humans, too, are imperfect. Remembering that, appreciating it, and even laughing at our imperfections keeps us whole. Our imperfections keep us going. They may help us to change and to adapt. Perhaps most significant in a discussion of the value of our imperfections is this. At the very core of our being, we all bear imperfections. There is no perfect human genome. As a species, we have survived adversity because of, not in spite of, our genetic variability, our imperfections. And just as defects in silicon enable it to function better under stress, our imperfections enable us to change and to adapt. They may also motivate us to explore and to create. At the very core of our being is our DNA, most of which we share with all living beings, including bacteria, plants, and earthworms. Unraveling of the human genome almost 20 years ago showed that of the 30,000 genes in human DNA, only 300 are different from those of mice. You probably know that. In humans, only 0.1% of our DNA accounts for variations among regional and ethnic groups and for our individual differences. Hardly enough, it seems, to substantiate any argument for superior beings of any size, shape, color, gender, belief, or mental capacity. In that 0.1%, reside all our differences, lie our strengths and our vulnerabilities, and the advantages and disadvantages which enable us to evolve and to survive as a species. In all living beings, over time, DNA slowly changes. Despite the constant vigilance of little enzyme repair patrols, sometimes something is missed and mutations, imperfections, in the original DNA result. Most mutations are lost over time, but sometimes a change prevails, giving one group a slight survival advantage over others of their kind. So consider, for example, a small group of prostitutes in Kenya, imperfect beings, as some might name them. They were discovered to be immune to HIV years ago. From their genes, a vaccine was developed, which may have contributed to saving many lives. If those women had not been who they were, their gift to humanity might surely have been lost. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus admonished his listeners to be perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. The Greek word, which has been translated perfect, is teleos. It is a root of the word teleology, that branch of philosophy that deals with ends or final causes, with explanations of purpose and intention. If you are an acorn, for example, your purpose is to become an oak. Jesus was not telling people to live their lives free of flaw or fault in a constant state of excellence. Neither was he telling them to practice each New Year's resolution without fail every day for an entire year, nor was he telling them to be better and better every day in every way. He was telling them to live with purpose, to be creative, to be true to themselves, to strive where their interests and abilities lay, to have integrity, and to live fully, blemishes and all, to enjoy life. Creation is good, not perfect, adequate to its purpose. And so are we, who are expressions of that creation, good, not perfect, adequate to our own purposes. Rather than seeking to live without fault, with a rigidity which just may cause us, like silicon, to shatter, Let us live fully, with integrity and an adequacy of purpose, remembering to appreciate our faults so that our children, our children's children, and we may truly enjoy being alive. So may it be.